I told you this is an exorcism, and we have a voice from beyond. I think that, well, first of all, Gavin's been very patient, and I don't know if all of you were here for me to introduce him, but I think we all know who he is. You don't need to. I'll let you take over for Joe.
Okay, in our usual, incredibly precisely organised way, Bill has sent me a thing to read. You can maybe judge after I've done his thing and done mine, which is the most dystopian. So just to read this out quickly. So Bill, how do we unfuck this? These are dangerous days. We see it in the renewed attacks on secure encryption embodied in laws like the Digital Economy Act and press coverage that holds end-to-end encryption responsible for interfering in due process, echoing the political line but also putting pressure on those communication channels that are outside the control of the established media owners. We see it in continued attacks on freedom of expression on the web, although since people continue to flock to private services with their own community standards in preference to places that make open expression paramount, there is little pushback. We see it in the imminent debasement of the idea of net neutrality to serve those US interests that fund the current administration, breaking the core principle of the end-to-end network to serve commercial interests. And we see it in the successful attempts, in the US at least, to treat all data as a commodity to be traded, to devalue the idea of data protection. This is against the background of a planet that is undergoing significant climate shifts as a result of human activity, and where there is simply no prospect for consensual action on the political stage to deal with the implications, attempt to arrest the process, or ameliorate the consequences. A lot of people will die earlier than they might have done as a result, and the conditions under which advanced technological civilization emerged will vanish for at least several thousand years. We may be able to use our skills to survive as a species, with some quality of life for some, or not. Sometimes I feel the superposition of wave state that defines current lived reality as a mist. Sometimes it's like Douglas Adams' Asgard glimpse when you turn your head just so. But I'm aware of it, and I realize that it will collapse. On one side is the grim mythic feature like Ridley Walker, but with Kent flooded and the Archbishop of Canterbury fled to the Welsh Hills. We ask, how many can we sustain and look for fresh water? On the other, we tend towards the singularity, never to arrive, of course, but shiny, happy technologies deliver the possibility of some form of a good life, even if it is a brave new world of control and careful limits on expression. The probability of the world dimly glimpsed over years of open tech and not-con, dreamed of at PunkCon and fought for at Newsweek House, seems low. Not a stable energy state.
Thanks, Bill.
Yeah.
Wow.
Bill was on the floor. Yeah, people at the back, please come forward. There's plenty of seats.
Welcome.
So, I think, just, there's Bill. I'm going to try and get the slides in a way that will appear on the screen.
It's very cheerful for somebody
from over
the world,
isn't it? Yeah, so Bill's in a good form. So I wanted to kind of actually quite neatly, as we always plan these things, into what I was going to talk about. So first of all, hello, my name is Gavin Starks. Welcome to everybody who's just joined. I was just reading out a section there from Bill Thompson, who's not able to be with us today, but thanks for in the good mood. My name is a little bit different, I'd say. We have to acknowledge that our threat model has changed. The world is not the same as it was at the last and there was a lot of kind of reaction which kind of makes you want to head for the fire escape, albeit the fire escape tends to be more weird than the place that we're standing right now. And we've also got a kind of reaction that we probably want to destroy the fire. I mean, particularly like this image of the fire extinguisher. perhaps we could distribute them around the White House and other buildings. But just to touched on this morning by Rachel about democracy and capitalism not being the same thing. I wonder how big the separation is, actually. Sort of one of the questions I've got mulling around is, we actually live in the world that we buy it. Now, whether we're buying into it with actual cash transactions or through our own personal data transactions. But these lines, I think, they've been becoming more blurred for a very long time. But I think it's a really interesting moment to exist in, and we have lots of really difficult questions to try and engage with. We're roughly halfway to connecting everyone. There's 5.5 billion people over 14 years old, and most of them have mobile phones. 2.5 billion of them have smartphones. And that's worldwide. And when you start then looking at how much money people are spending online, the kind of e-commerce spend has been growing, continues to be relentless, £350 billion a year. But that's still only 6% of the total retail amount in the US. But the trend you can see is we'll be looking at this graph in 10 years' time, we will be seeing the hockey stick here. So there's a really direct, from my perspective, like a kind of causal relationship between money and all of the issues that we're trying to address here. And at the same time, you've got this shift, this chart here, it's a bit dark up there, but the lower line is Wintel, the red line, and the orange line here is the growth of Google, Apple, Facebook, and Amazon, or GAFA, as it's called. So this is their annual revenue, and you can see it's just growing and growing and growing. So we are in an oligopoly, appropriate words, rather than a monopoly. And you know, this, as we are all familiar with in this room, starts to ask really new, difficult questions about what is the social contract and the commercial contract between these organisations and the state, and these organisations and individuals. And we've got people like Google saying, we're going to move from mobile first to AI first. I think that's quite a powerful statement. So I've looked at the investment that has been made in mobile and smartphones and getting everybody online to say that we're going to start investing in AI first. We're just really the early stages of this. And if you look at the kind of transitions that have gone in machine learning, from modeling things, just throwing all the data into neural network, you're seeing a 10x improvement in a lot of these predictive models in a very short period of time. But it's not all good. You can do the same thing. So Google took the platform that won gold and they applied it to their data centers, and they got 15% energy saving. So that fits in with my experience over the last 15 years of trying to do stuff on climate change. Most organizations can save 10 to 15% of their energy if they apply the right analytics to what they're doing. So that's been a pattern that I've observed over many years. So it's really interesting to see them codify that. And at the same time, you have this other bit of language. I like destroying this language, but annoying. And so The Economist came out with a piece last week, saying that most valuable resource is no longer oil, but data. And there's been a decade of people drawing comparisons of data being the new oil. And so I think I'd just like to say it isn't. Its value is not based on scarcity, but it's based on abundance. And I think the analogy also is extremely limited in a whole bunch of different ways that actually cripple our ability to think about how we should be thinking about data. So first of all, data doesn't run out. And the economic model for a commodity that doesn't run out is much more like solar power than it is oil. And so that should be informing our thinking about what kind of business model should we do around the information. Secondly, data increases in value the more it's connected. So again, an economic model for a commodity that creates value the more it's connected. So it's maybe more accurate to say the web of data is the new web of documents. 20 years has been largely connecting documents and just starting to connect the data. You can make a copy of the data for effectively zero cost. Well, it's harder to copy the connections, the highest in the connection. And of course, as a climate geek as well, data doesn't directly cause catastrophic climate change, you think that it does. Although, you know, I think the internet broadly now uses 10% global energy, so we have to also make sure we've got clean energy.
Mostly Bitcoin.
What's that?
Mostly Bitcoin.
Yeah, mostly Bitcoin. Important. And you know, we also, just to run with the climate analogy, we may soon need data sequestration for all of our binary dust as we end up in a situation which I kind of think most data is very difficult from the very shiny image that is presented by organisations, most countries and companies, and it's incredible shiny data centres. That picture of the Google data centre area is sort of immaculate colours in day, but actually I think our data wastelands, we're going to create all of this data and have it sort of lying around. As we're discovering, you can just see the codes from the XP now. Just creating a whole series of problems for ourselves that we will have to actually end up trying to clean up later. And I think when you touched on this a little bit with the data cleansers or the data
obfuscators.
Yeah, it is who's going to go around and tidy this shit up? You know, it's just everywhere, and you know, companies going bust. I think Radio Shack sold its database in the US, which had 23 million people in it. I don't think anybody would have particularly wanted to be then in somebody else's database. And I think, you know, with all of this kind of machine learning and our applications of technology, you do end up with humans implementing this stuff when they don't really know what it is, how to use it, or why. You can watch this for hours. It's an extra day, actually, to do this presentation because I got stuck on this. I think it's a really important point on this. When we design these things, we expect intelligent usage, or we expect informed consent, we expect an understanding of what people are doing and why. That applies both to the end user, it also applies to the people deploying systems. And so when you kind of look at this kind of implementation of, you know, APIs or even just people building terrible websites, you do get to this kind of wasteland pretty quickly. Anyway, so that's kind of a slight next view. So let's take a different perspective here. So we can think about data as infrastructure, and this is something that the ODI developed and has been pushing for into the kind of political sphere for some time, to try and get them to think about data in a different way. And so we can draw this comparison of open roads underpin our physical economy, open networks underpin our digital economy, and open data can underpin our knowledge economy. And given that everything is linked, at least have an interface of that knowledge economy, this becomes an incredibly important principle to work on. So you've got a nice clear road there to navigate down. Typically though, we tend to, bit by bit, the gates image, we make things really complicated really quickly. This is a sign of the Japanese horse race. You've got to read this when you're traveling 70 miles an hour. Good luck. That would be my kind of starting point. And that made me think actually about my own sort of random walk of a career. I set up a company called CI, which helps host about 25% of the world's music and distributes it around the world. Set up a company called AIMI, aggregating the world's environmental data and standards. Helps set up the Open Data Institute. I'm on the board of trustees for think of the long player, which is a piece of music that's designed to last for 1,000 years, and more recently at the weekend quantum computing. So I don't know what any of that means. But that's part of my random walk is to say, you know, what's next? How do we start moving forward? And so one of the projects I'm working on at the moment is around anti-slavery. So there's new legislation in the UK which requires every company that turns over more than £20 million to disclose publicly anti-modern slavery statements. How are they going to address this in their supply chain? So really, that's going to be interesting piece here. In their supply chain, how do they go about doing that? And estimates range between 14 and 20 million, or perhaps even too higher, because there's up to 40 million people falling under the definition of modern slavery state. So we're building an open registry of all those statements, kind of starting point to say to our organisations that we'll start wiring up this ecosystem of data. Every company thinks that surely they don't have slavery in the supply chain, every company probably does. Soon you go offshore, it becomes very fussy very quickly. And at the same time, there's a company called Provenance, which we actually incubated at the ODI, just joining the board of. And they use blockchain to create an audit history right the way through the supply chain. So you can take fishermen in Indonesia, tag a fish, they can use their mobile phones to do it, and all the way through 15 different companies in 7 countries to the shelf and same for us. So we're starting to build these models now which have scalability as a feature. And I think it's quite interesting what happens when you put those two businesses together. And part of my thinking at the moment, questions I've got, which I'd love to discuss, are what are the orthogonal attack vectors here on the systems that we're trying to change? So it's very hard to say, well, we don't want to do anything around anti-slavery. It's very hard to say we don't want to know what's going on in the supply chain. But these create really interesting data sets and really interesting levers from which you can then infer lots and lots of other things. You can start matching up with corporates, spend network, and so on. So I'll come back to that in a second. this is a. So one of the things we've been really focused on the user needs, and this is a great example of something being a petition saying there are too many bees in Surrey, something must be done about the high population volume of bees in and around my town. And no bees are important to the ecosystem, my wife doesn't like them, and I'm chasing them for a bus. this sort of tickled me because I've always had a bit of an issue with the idea of focusing on user needs. I think the language itself is very individual-focused. It doesn't necessarily open up into what are the communities, what are the broader cultural interfaces. So it's quite I'm a massive fan, don't get me wrong, user needs absolutely a huge champion of. But I think the language itself, it'd be great to come up with a slightly different phrase. I don't know what that phrase is. Chatting with Joe Ito, recently from MIT, and he's just published a book actually where he's got some really interesting sort of snapshot of how to think about how you navigate this future. One of the phrases that I particularly liked was that to try and navigate through into creating the change we want to see in the world, we need compasses, not maps. Because we've got no clue what the country's going to look like this time next year. But we do need to have a look around us and say, what are the interesting signals right now? What patterns can we build upon? I just want to close up on two examples. One of them is last year we created a thing called the Open Banking Standard, and that brought together the Treasury, the regulators, the high street banks, the startups, human rights folks, and we managed to create something which turned into regulation within the next 6 months of publishing the report, which I was astounded by, and actually I don't think a lot of the people involved in it particularly understood what we're putting in there, but it does mandate creating open APIs for your personal data, sorting out the legal framework for that, sorting out the liabilities, sorting out all the policy questions, and so on. And again, if it's done right, and I think it will take some time, it's just a really important and interesting precedent for other sectors. I'm not saying you necessarily need to go into the banking sector, so have a look at that. It's on the ODI website. And see what could be copied for other sectors. That helps us get towards some of our agenda points. And my kind of closing piece really is, if we're looking to try and create impact at web scale, when frankly everything feels like it's derailed over the last 12 to 18 months. What are the components? How do we create, how do we do things differently? So I've been coming to these events for far too long.
10 years at least.
That's
14,
I was thinking. Yeah. A long time. Two years. And there's been the most incredible things have been announced here. The people involved in this community make the most remarkable things and create the most remarkable change. And that is a huge credit to everyone here. Looking at what's happened over the last year in particular, I think now we need to kind of up our game more. I think we need to somehow engage in enterprise businesses, medium-sized businesses, small businesses in a different way. We need to engage with the investment community in a different way. There's lots of startups now that are pro-social, it's a phrase they hate. So I'm trying to destroy that, as I mentioned. But the trying to bring together these components of how do we think about policy and how do we weave policy into what we are doing? How do we think about infrastructure for organizations of whatever kind of organization so that they can see how they're going to make money out of it, they can see how they're going to scale, and then how do you think about how that impacts culture? So policy, infrastructure, and culture are my three categories for discussion. I'm trying to think about this at the moment in terms of which organizations we get around the table, pick a problem and see if we can solve it, or at least make a dent in it, in the same similar way we did with the open banking standard and other initiatives. But it's really early days, so please just get in touch with me if you're interested in having a chat. And this is a massive topic, unless I'm doing justice, but I think this is my pattern recognition, is something really interesting brewing.